Hello, and welcome to another episode of Golden Grenades, a podcast about birds with stories from those of us who worship them, all set against the heartwarming and uplifting backdrop of the end of the world. Today, my special guest is Henry Day. Henry is 11 years old and is absolutely crazy about wildlife and conservation. He loves nothing more than exploring the natural world around his home in East Anglia and beyond, and sharing his adventures on his blog, socials, and YouTube channel. He is a junior wildlife ambassador for the Wildlife Trust for Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire, and Nottinghamshire, has given a rousing speech on stage at the Restore Nature Now March in London. He's won a Nature Storyteller of the Year award, and he's even asked David Attenborough his thoughts on communicating about nature. Did I mention he's only 11? Henry, welcome to Golden Grenades.
Hi, Kit.
How are you today?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, I hear you've been a bit poorly, but I'm very grateful that you're feeling better and you're happy to have a chat about birds and all things nature today. We met at Global Bird Fair in the summer, didn't we? And you had a very special book with you.
Yeah, so I always had my Into the Red book with me taking signatures.
Yeah, so that was so cool because I've got my copy of Into the Red and I actually get people to sign their page when I see them as well, like an autograph book. And I've only ever met one person who does that as well, and that's you. Did you get many?
Just a couple, not many though.
Ah, but you got some. When I met you, you were at the talk that our friend Will Rose was doing on animation and birds. So I'm sure Will signed his page for you.
Yes, I made sure I got that.
And I noticed as well you'd been to Springwatch. You might have got a couple of signatures there.
Yeah, I got Jack Badham's and People's Page.
Brilliant, brilliant. Lucy Lapwing?
Yep.
Awesome. How was your trip to Springwatch? I've been. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really incredible seeing how all the electronical stuff goes on behind it just to get the show on the road.
I know, I love that. The truck with all the cameras and all the webcams and stuff. It's wicked. So I wanted to ask you, Henry, because, you know, like I said in the introduction there, you're 11, but you've been crazy about wildlife for a long time. When did your love of wildlife and nature first start, do you think?
I think I've always been interested in nature and loved seeing the garden birds and the bugs in the garden. My parents have a video of me at the age of 2, stood by the bird feeder that I just refilled, shouting, "Birds! Birds! I have food for you!" And then turning around and heading into the house because, well, my enthusiasm scared them away.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the best way to attract birds to your garden. But actually, do you know, I do something similar. I have like a robin in my garden that is quite tame at the moment. And I like make a little noise to try and attract it. I've got no idea whether it works or not, but I make a silly noise to try and get my robin to come. So yeah, it's maybe not that bad an idea after all. So you've always loved birds then, I guess.
Yeah, it's always been their passion.
As far as you can remember. And was it birds first? Because I know you love all nature. Was it birds that you started with?
I think it was birds and bugs, because they're the things you can really engage with from a young age.
Definitely. And you can, and they're so accessible. You can find them anywhere, can't you?
Turn over a log and then you've got some bugs there. Whereas other things, if you're a little kid and you're running towards them, they'll just run away. So those things are more accessible.
Exactly. I mean, imagine if you were obsessed with giant pandas.
Yeah.
You're never going to
see one from a young age.
No, that's no good at all. So yeah, bugs and birds, that's a fine choice. And then you started taking your interest in wildlife further, didn't you?
Yes. So I started in lockdown making videos because I had more time. And that's what got me, the Wildlife Trust, interested. And I started making videos for them and was their junior wildlife ambassador.
That's brilliant. So you effectively had a job.
Yeah.
And how old were you then? So if that was like in lockdown, I guess, were you like 7 or 8?
Oh, 6.
6?
Yeah.
Blimey. You had a job at the age of 6?
Pretty much.
That's amazing. And I guess it must be hard. I mean, once you went back to school and things like that, were you still able to make your videos?
Yeah, it was much easier to do them at the weekends than on school holidays than during the school week, though.
Yeah, I bet, I bet. And you also do a blog and you have your socials, don't you? Instagram and things like that.
They're at the moment easier because I don't need to be doing as much because now I'm at senior school, I've got sports, homework, and clubs. And also, when I'm at nature reserves, I'm doing something. So long, like video clips, it takes more time out of what I'm doing than a couple of snaps on social.
Yeah, much easier, I think. What do your friends make of it all? I mean, the fact that you're so crazy about nature, because I know that a lot of kids don't necessarily think that birds and nature's cool, but what do your friends think of it all?
Well, I found that you just need to remind them of how amazing some things are, like how some birds can do these really amazing things that are right under their noses, and that helps to inspire them.
Definitely, definitely. What sort of bird things would you tell them about to get them interested, do you think?
Well, I would tell them about seabirds or like some of the common, like goldfinches or something, with their coloration.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And once people start to notice things.
Another bird I often tell them about is the red kite and the reintroduction stories and things. Around here, we have a couple of people who feed them and things. So over school, at times you'll see like 40, 50 in one time. It's incredible.
Amazing. Oh, they're fantastic birds. We've got peregrines down on the river by me. And, if I'm there with my binoculars or my telescope and I see somebody that's half interested, they're looking at what I'm doing or whatever, I'll point out the peregrine. And they don't know it's there until you show them, and then you tell them it's the fastest bird on the planet and then blow their minds. Brilliant. Well, I think you and I can both agree and confirm to anybody else that birds are very cool, even if some people think they're not. But we need to get down to business, Henry, because this podcast is, well, the premise of it is that, in the not too distant future, because of everything that's going on with the environment and climate change, we could end up in serious trouble. And you have to choose five bird species to save from extinction. Because let's face it, we all know, and Chris Packham says, all birds are equal, but some birds are more equal than others. So there are top birds, and dare I say it, there are flop birds. Not really, I guess. Some birds make the most beautiful, intricate nests, and some whack three sticks on a branch and call that a nest. Some catch and kill monkeys for their dinner. Some eat out of bins. But you're going to choose five very cool birds, I'm sure of it. So let's talk about your five favorite birds, and we'll start with bird number one.
Bird number one.
So my bird number one is the ruff. I'm not sure if I've seen one. They can be hard to identify among other waders. There was one when we were at RSPB Merton Mere, but we couldn't spot it amongst all the other brown birds. So in the apocalypse, if we were to save it, I'll definitely be able to see it. This means they won't go extinct without me seeing one. And they'd be the only wader, so they'll be easier to identify.
This is a good thought. Yeah, I don't think anybody's used this tactic before, Henry, but I can see where you're coming from.
Reading your book Into the Red, it got me so excited about seeing a ruff. Jess French's poem sums it up really well, and I actually use this as part of my poem reading in my recent Lambda exam.
Really? You used Jess French's poem from the book? Oh, wow. Did you pass the exam?
Yeah, with a distinction, which is the highest mark you can get.
Oh, well done. That's brilliant.
Do you want me to read it to you?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, please do.
Ruff. Wader identification is tough. A dash of brown, a flash of buff, a little round head, and sure enough, I find all these and more on the ruff. With its medium legs, medium size, medium bill, and small dark eyes, the ruff is a master of disguise. I fail again. It's no surprise. So woe betide the next ornithophile that seeks a ruff while juvenile. The search may last for quite a while, and many others share its style. in May and June. I am treated to a different plume, a glorious crown. I gush and swoon, and then no doubt I change my tune. The ruff I cry in all its splendor, as clear as day, that's no pretender. And now I know, I must remember, just seek out the ZZ gender. Then, alas, once all are bred, all colours gone, all feathers shed, I'll stare at the marsh with familiar dread, peer through bins, and scratch my head.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Henry. That's so cool that you used that poem from Into the Red in your exam and got a distinction as well. That's wicked. They are, though, very tricky birds, aren't they, to identify?
Incredibly.
Have you looked at what they look like and their breeding plumage in books?
Yeah, it's incredible with that massive crown and
Yeah.
cape around their neck and things.
Yeah, I think, in the olden days, like the Tudors wore what they called a ruff around their neck and that big sort of ridiculous thing that they wore. And that's why the bird is called a ruff. It's named after that thing that the Tudors used to wear. But we don't tend to see the breeding ones in the UK very much. I think there might be a handful of birds that breed up in the wilds of Scotland in very secret places. But yeah, I remember looking at bird books as a kid and seeing them with all those crazy feathers around their neck and on their head and thinking I'd love to see that. And I kind of assumed that one day I would, but I think unless you go somewhere overseas to see them at the right times, they're going to be very difficult. And I don't know if you know this, but it's kind of referenced in that poem that it's not just males and females they have. There's a couple of the males that are a little bit odd. They have plumage like females, and they at the breeding season when the males with all their big feathers and all of that are strutting about and trying to attract the ladies, some of the ones that look female sneak in when the fellas are strutting their stuff and mate with the females. So it's a very rare example where there is more than two gender types of birds that are they're really quite unusual in that sense as well. Yeah, that's pretty cool about the ruff. Yeah, and here's a final fact about ruffs. In medieval times, it was a delicacy. Like I think a lot of birds were back then, waders and seabirds, and it was an expensive treat at the banquet table. And in 1465, Archbishop Neville's enthronement banquet served up 2,400 ruffs were served
Whoa.
at the feast. 2,400.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. I'd struggle to eat one, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, they used to eat loads of them, and then the numbers went down like a lot of birds, and then habitat loss took its toll, hence why they're on the red list. Yeah, so we don't get to see them doing all the strutting and stuff. But yeah, maybe one day we will. Let's not give up hope.
Yes.
All right, so that was the ruff. Let's move on to your second choice.
Bird number two.
My second choice is the Anna's hummingbirds. I had to put a hummingbird in because they're so unique. They're a special family of birds, and they are tougher than they look. I saw my first hummingbirds in the wild this year, and they are awesome. They're fast, really energetic, and really colourful. We were on a mainly nature-based holiday on the west coast of Canada, and first saw a rufous hummingbird in Stanley Park, Vancouver. It was zipping along the path and stream in the woods. Then we saw an Anna's hummingbird most days around Vancouver, and we were able to get really good sightings of them and quite close. They were mesmerising as they were doing their courtship dance. The male flies up into the sky, then dives down, passing the female. They were going really high and singing lots. Male Anna's hummingbirds are beautiful, green and pinks, and their feathers are shiny like gemstones. They are one of the only three hummingbirds that live permanently in Canada and the United States. How do they do this? They spend the time in the winter along the Pacific coast, which is unique among hummingbirds. When it gets cold outside, Anna's hummingbirds enter a state called torpor, and it's kind of semi-hibernation, during which their heart rate and breathing slows. During torpor, their body temperatures can reach as low as about 9 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
And this might be one of the reasons that Anna's hummingbirds is actually increasing in numbers. But a stronger reason is that more people are putting out hummingbird feeders, which they go to.
Amazing. Hummingbirds are incredible birds, aren't they? And I mean, so they're one of only three that don't migrate, is that right?
Yes, they stay permanently in Canada and US.
All year round. Could you imagine if you could get hummingbirds? I mean, like, people get them in their gardens, don't they? Like you say, putting feeders out. It's crazy to think that those amazing looking birds would come into your garden.
Yeah. We were in a hotel, just walked outside and like two or three just zipped past. They were just everywhere.
Oh, man. And the Anna's hummingbird, like you described, they've got that emerald green back, haven't they? And then that bright pink throat and head, and it's just so shiny. I think I read on the Audubon website that they're more like flying jewellery than birds.
Yeah.
And did you actually see them doing the thing when they go up high and then dive down?
Yeah, plummeting down.
That's amazing.
When we saw it, we thought it was just something that they do. We didn't realise it was their courtship.
Yeah. Apparently they go up to about 40 metres, 130 feet up in the air, and then zip down dead quick.
Mad.
Amazing. Do you know how old the oldest Anna's hummingbird on record is?
No.
8 years old.
Whoa.
Yeah, for such a tiny bird.
Their size.
Yeah.
Far tougher than they look.
They must be, especially if they can survive like cold winters. Yeah. They're amazing. So the Anna's hummingbird I read was first described in 1829 by a French ornithologist, and he named it after Anna Messina, the Duchess of Rivoli. Oh. I have to admit, I don't know who she is, but she's very lucky to have such a beautiful bird named after her. And something I do on this podcast, Henry, is I always think of a question that I will ask my guest, hopefully a question that they've never been asked before. And a question that maybe they'll never get asked again, I don't know, but I call it my zero punches pulled question.
Zero punches pulled.
And my question for you is that Anna Messina had a hummingbird named after her. If you could have any species of bird named after you, what would it be?
Your brain automatically goes to the big, impressive eagles and things. But I think one of the smaller birds that do massive migrations would be cool, like maybe a swift or a house pigeon type bird.
Henry's swift, that would be cool. I wondered if I was going to choose one. I thought maybe Kit's pipit, because at least it would mean I would be able to identify one pipit. But then I decided Kit's kite. I would probably have to have a kite, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah. Henry's swift. So if anybody finds a new species of swift, we know who you can name it after.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing I was going to say is Anna's hummingbird, although they're an absolutely amazing looking bird, it is quite a simple name compared to some hummingbirds. They've got crazy names, some of them, like Lucifer's short tail, bearded mountaineer, shining sunbeam, fairies and comets, wood nymphs and mountain gems. They're almost more like moth names, aren't they?
Yeah. We went to the Natural History Museum of Tring, and they have a cabinet with lots of hummingbirds. And you just look around, you see these tiny little ones, look beneath it, it's got a like five-word name, and it's just incredible for their size. You think that you would give a bigger bird a bigger name, but these tiny little hummingbirds have got huge names.
Yeah, huge and sometimes ridiculous names as well. So maybe Anna's hummingbird, she's got off quite lightly with such a simple name. Okay, well, that's another great choice, Henry. Let's move on to your third choice.
Bird number three.
It has to be the Northern Gannet. This is my favourite bird. They had to make the list. I love their cool adaptations, being able to feed the way they do. They feed by plunging into the water from a height up to 60 miles per hour, and they can catch fish up to 40 metres below the surface. Their adaptations include no external nostrils, so the water doesn't get forced into them. They have air sacs on their chest connected to their lungs, so they can cushion the blow of hitting the water at speed. They have membranes over their eyes, so they can still see, and a really strong neck and muscles and bone structure to protect their whole body.
They're amazing birds, aren't they?
Yeah.
I know you've seen them before because you've talked about them on one of your videos, haven't you? Where did you go to see yours?
We went to Bempton Cliffs, which is a unique and amazing place where you see the smell and noise, and it's incredible. It's a unique spectacle.
Absolutely, it is a spectacle. It's one of, I think, Britain's most amazing bird spectacles, the gannets. I'm in the northeast, up just south of Scotland, and Bass Rock's up here, so we have our colony there, and we get the birds from Bass Rock flying at the coast beside me. Whoa. I could watch them for hours.
Yeah, we also saw some of the last jumplings. The jumplings are the baby gannets, and they are called this because before they can properly fly, they jump off the cliffs and then spend the next few weeks on the water being fed until they are ready to fly.
Yeah, and they're funny looking things, aren't they?
Yeah.
Until they get their adult plumage, which can take quite a long time, I think. And you know, they used to eat them in the bad old days, you know, especially the babies. I think they used to call them googers, and they used to plunder them off the rocks in the hundreds, you know, just when people needed food back then. And they used to sell them from Shetland and places in Scotland to fancy restaurants in London. And they used to call it Highland Goose. That's what they used to call baby gannets. But yeah, they're amazing, amazing birds. When I think about my top five, gannets always in there.
Yeah. Last year, the British Antarctic Survey did a study on the northern gannet and discovered that they are right or left winged. What does this mean? When they dive, they roll onto one side in order to keep an eye on their prey. They discovered that different birds have a different preference for rolling left or right, with a roughly 50-50 split. Apparently, most vertebrates show some degree of left or right-sidedness, and scientists think this is a way of making it easier to learn complex tasks, because you only have to learn one way of doing it.
I did not know that. What a brilliant fact that is. 50-50 split between left and right-wingedness.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Hey, you're teaching me stuff here today, Henry. I didn't know that. That's brilliant. Oh, here's one that you might not know. 2/3 of the world's population of gannets, which is around about 180,000 pairs, nest around the UK and those few sites that we have.
Okay.
So yeah, 2/3 of the world's population around the UK.
One claim to fame the UK has.
Yeah, exactly. And they did quite badly with the avian flu, didn't they? They were one of the species that were hit quite badly by that.
And the ones that did survive the flu but had it, the way you could tell that they'd had it is their eye colour changed.
That's right. Yeah, it did. Hey, you know your gannet facts. No wonder it's your favourite bird. You know all about them. Right. Fantastic. Let's move on, Henry, and talk about your fourth bird.
Bird number four.
Bird number four is the stonechat. I've never grown out of searching for nature, but now I get involved in the monitoring and research projects at my local wildlife trust. I've always been searching for cooler animals, and now I'm searching for even cooler animals like water vole signs or bird of prey. This bird is like the symbol of those projects for me, and I'd love to pursue a career in monitoring and research, or science in the future. The Great Fen is actually a really big Wildlife Trust reserve, which consists of three nature reserves, including Wood Walton Fen, which is the second oldest nature reserve, and farmland being managed or restored to its natural fenland state. There are a few bird projects I've helped with, including vantage point surveys, looking for birds of prey mainly, and a survey and ringing project on stonechat, my number four bird. Stonechat started to reappear over winter in the Great Fen, so the bird ringers obtained a license to start colour ringing them to track them. I can't help with the ringing, although I do get to watch sometimes, and I would like to get involved in ringing in the future. But I'm good at spotting them and recording the colour rings. Often you hear them before you see them, and their call is quite distinctive, like two stones being tapped together. In 2022, there was a number of breeding pairs across the Great Fen, meaning they were now staying all year round, and not just hosting migrants. Recently, on a vantage point survey, I was looking for barn owls and marsh owls, and one of the ring stone traps appeared near the hide that we were in.
Awesome. So you helped to monitor and record stone chats?
Yeah, it was really cool. Although I wasn't allowed to do the actual practical bit, I was on the recording the colour rings and telling them which rings and order to put on.
Brilliant. How old do you have to be to have a ringing licence?
No idea.
I don't know either. 16 sounds about right, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so
often age for those type of things, isn't it?
Yeah.
16 or 18.
I think it might be 16. Let's hope it's 16 anyway, because that's sooner than 18. And stone chats are really smart looking birds, aren't they, as well? Especially the males with the, you know, their sort of black face, and they've got that white collar, and then they've got that rusty undercarriage. They're quite beautiful, aren't they?
Yes.
They're quite easy to spot as well.
Yeah, because they stand at the top of dead hemlock or posts and things. So they're just there so you can see them.
Yeah, I think it's very decent of them to make themselves easy to see. And then, like you say, they make that they make that noise, don't they? Like you said, about like it's like stones hitting together. And I think that's where the name comes from. And they're one of our, maybe a little bit like what you were talking about, the Anna's hummingbirds staying all year round. These are one of our birds that stay all year round. Like you said there, you know, they stay through the winter, don't they? Which is quite unusual, I think, for a bird that feeds on insects. And it can be quite dangerous for them, I guess, you know, if we had a bad winter weather-wise, if there was less food for them.
Yeah.
But they are pretty cool. Did you know that in Scotland, it used to be thought of in ancient folklore that they were like birds of the devil, that they had satanic powers, and that if anybody harmed a stone chat or took eggs from their nest, that some sort of horrible illness or evil would befall them. They were a bird that people sort of like did think that was somehow connected to spooky goings on.
That's interesting.
Yeah. You could go to Halloween fancy dress party dressed as a stone chat.
Yeah.
You might get some funny looks, but you'd have a good reason for it.
And then people would come to you and like, why are you dressed like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it would look a bit weird. I like some of their old names as well, like the names that don't get used anymore. Blacky Top, Chick Stone, Furs Chitter, Stain Chacker. A lot of birds used to have some cool names in the olden days. We've never had Stone Chat on the podcast before, so this was a first.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm pleased with that. Anna's hummingbird and stone chat we've never talked about before. So yeah, good choices. Oh, and we've never talked about a ruff before either. So yeah.
Whoop, whoop.
Three of your choices we've never talked about. That's brilliant. So this leads us, Henry, up to your fifth and final bird. So tell us about
bird number five.
My fifth bird is the white-tailed eagle. It's my final bird, but it had to be on the list, because they're so impressive when you see them. I had some very memorable experiences with them on the Isle of Mull. They were also on my list because of the amount of work that went on reintroducing them to the UK. The white-tailed eagle, or white-tailed sea eagle, as the expert Dave Sexton calls them, is such a majestic bird of prey soaring through the skies, looking like their nickname, the Flying Barn Doors. On our first day on Mull, we saw them near Loch Na Keal, and then it was pretty much every other day we saw them there. And they were always very incredible to see. We were also saw one still on its nest, and it was nicknamed Big Baby because it was still on the nest weeks after it should have fledged. The parents were still feeding it. It did eventually fly. So we think it was just a bit lazy and liked being fed.
Why not?
One of the highlights of my white-tailed eagle experiences on Mull didn't involve actually seeing the birds. We met up with Dave Sexton, who has recently retired from being the Mull white-tailed eagle ranger for many years. He took us out for the afternoon in his truck. The weather was awful, so we drove to a point where we could see the original nest site. He told us lots of stories about egg collectors, the community helping protect the nest, and how they were flown by RAF jets, and loads of other fascinating stories. But we didn't see the eagles that day in the rain and fog. It didn't matter because it was still an incredible experience hearing about the reintroduction of this cool bird. While we're talking about the white-tailed eagle, can I tell you about another experience from Canada?
Please do, yeah.
The bald eagle is like a cousin to the white-tailed eagle, and we took a boat trip through the Discovery Islands, including one small island absolutely covered in bald eagles. Some of the huge pine trees look like Christmas trees with the white heads dotted all over them like baubles.
Wicked. That would be awesome to see. I've seen bald eagles before, but I've only ever just one. But you saw a whole tree full.
Yeah, there was 300-ish on this island.
That is crazy. That must have been so cool to see.
Yeah, it was really mad.
Which, if you had to say, which do you think is the coolest though? Bald eagle or white-tailed eagle?
I think white-tailed eagle from all the experiences that I had. Although, bald eagle, we got off the plane to Canada and just to adjust, we went to this place called Iona Beach and we said we would only go halfway along the spit and we just kept walking, got all the way to the end and then these two bald eagles flew over and it was really incredible. Just, we hadn't even been in Canada for like over 2 hours and we'd already seen bald eagles.
That is pretty cool. It was worth doing that extra bit of walk.
When we walked all the way back, there were ospreys up above, so that reminded us of home.
So you had bald eagles and ospreys in your first 2 or 3 hours in Canada.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Amazing, amazing. So white-tailed eagles are a massive success story, aren't they, in terms of, like you said, the reintroduction programs in Scotland and more recently in the Isle of Wight in England as well. So did you know, I mean, one of the reasons why we lost them for so long, or you know, was because they were persecuted, because people used to call them lamb killers. They used to think they used to take their livelihoods, you know, the farmers used to think they used to take their lambs, but, you know, that's not really true. They might take the odd sick one. Yeah, or the dead ones, but, you know, they generally don't do that. And they used to have a bad reputation as well. I don't know if you know this, it's a bit gruesome, for being baby snatchers.
Ooh.
Yeah. So here's a fact, but there's a pub in Oxford called the Eagle and Child. And there's outside the pub, the sign is of an eagle carrying a baby. And it's the pub where Tolkien used to go and meet C.S. Lewis, his pal. And they used to talk about writing books and they planned the Lord of the Rings books and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe books in that pub. Yeah, yeah. And it was named after white-tailed eagles stealing babies, which is obviously a fiction as well.
Yeah. Fiction. Quite a fiction.
Exactly. Bald eagles, though, I don't think they've ever been accused of snatching babies. Because they take a lot of dead stuff, don't they, as well?
Yeah.
And they'll steal food off... Yeah, they'll steal food off ospreys and they'll let other birds do the dirty work and all the hard work, and then they'll come and steal it, which is pretty impressive in itself if you're that tough.
Into my five birds, the white-tailed eagles also do that with gannets. So gannet comes up and they'll just swoop in and take and startle the gannet. It releases the fish. White-tailed eagle comes in and takes the fish.
Do you know what? As much as I love gannets, I would love to see that happen.
Yeah.
That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Brilliant. So, you've chosen five amazing birds there, Henry. But, as you know, this podcast is based around an environmental apocalypse, and you've bundled these five species onto the ark to save them from certain extinction. But if you have to choose one, and I think I might know which one it's going to be, you have to choose one to be your spirit guide that will... be with you and keep you company as you walk the wastelands looking for other species to save. Which bird species would you choose?
I think it has to be the gannet.
Good choice. It would also get your tea for you.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Great choice. So, Henry, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been great talking to you and hearing all about your five favourite birds. Can you tell me if you've got any new videos planned or any projects coming up?
Well, I've got a fundraising event planned with a friend from school, but we're still working on the details. But it will definitely involve the fens. You've probably guessed, I love the fence. It's definitely my happy place. I'll be sharing the plans soon and hope to raise lots of money for the Wildlife Trust, RSPB and National Trust.
Awesome. Well, we'll look out for that and good luck with it. But I'll certainly share that on my socials as well when the time comes. We'll certainly look out for that coming. Brilliant.
This winter, we're going to visit RSPB Minsmere to see all the migrants, including Buick and Hooper swans. And of course, at some point, I'd like to see a ruff.
Excellent. So you've got your hit list mapped out. I never used to think about birdwatching so much in the winter, but you've got it right. You know, you can still get out and you can still see exciting things at wintertime, all the geese and the swans. Yeah, there's still lots of things to see, isn't there, even in the colder months?
Yeah, you don't really think it, but when you actually get out there and look, there is still lots and lots that you can see, because we always think that you get migrants in the summer that come here, but we get migrants in the winter as well, like the Buick and Hooper swans.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what I get excited about more than anything, any time of year, is waxwings, you know.
Yeah.
In case we get some more this winter, because it was a good winter last year.
Yeah, we went to a local town to see them, and there was this strip down with the trees they like, and we went, nothing.
Oh,
we went
no.
Later, and we saw like five or six of them just flitting between these trees on the tops of houses, and it was amazing.
Oh, fantastic. I'm glad you get to see them. Could you hear them as well? Because they make a really weird noise, like a really high-pitched sort of...
I couldn't hear them. It was
a bit far away.
But yeah. It was still a really good experience.
Oh, they're beautiful birds. Yeah, they would make it in my top five as well. Right. Oh, well, listen, Henry, thank you so much for coming on. It's been lovely talking to you. And good luck with your secret fundraiser.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.